Welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I meet Joel and Ethan Cohen as they get serious about being Jewish in their masterpiece, A Serious Man. I find out why the Cohens resisted the comedy of bar mitzvah nostalgia until now. Michael Caine is back with Righteous Indignation and a big angry gun in Harry Brown. I meet its director, Daniel Barber, to talk about working with a legend and why London streets are so mean. And Zan Brooks and I review Michael Haneke's Palm d'Or winner, The White Ribbon, Ang Lee's 60s Wallow, Taking Woodstock, and Bish Bosh Bash, Roland Emmerich turns the disaster movie up to 11 with 2012. Yes, it's better than being a pork pie at a bar mitzvah. It's Film Weekly. Not only did they have a womb in common, but Joel and his younger brother Ethan Cohen are often referred to in Hollywood as the two-headed director. Both of them, for example, accepted the Oscar for No Country for Old Men. But they make movies that play with genre too, from Barton Fink to The Big Lebowski. Menace and humour mingle as they jump cut between the profane and the profound, from Technicolor to snowscapes and sepia, from bluegrass to Jefferson Airplane. Their latest film, A Serious Man, extends the definition of Coen-esque, doing something that until now they've resisted, exploring their own middle-class, middle-America Jewish upbringing. The film tells the story of Jewish physics professor Larry Gopnik, played brilliantly by Michael Stuhlbarg, whose life, as his son's bar mitzvah approaches, is starting to unravel. Larry seeks solace and wisdom from three eminent rabbis, especially when his wife reveals that she's taken Cy Abelman as a lover.
Really, to keep things on an even keel leading up to Danny's bar mitzvah.
Child's bar mitzvah.
Cy and I think it's best if you move out of the house.
Move out? Well, it makes eminent sense.
Things can't continue, is it?
Move out? Where would I go? Oh, for instance, the Jolly Roger is quite livable. It's not expensive. The rooms are eminently habitable.
This would allow you to visit the kids.
There's convenience in its favor. You've got a pool.
Wouldn't it make more sense for you to move in with Cy?
Yeah.
Larry, you are jesting.
I loved A Serious Man, and when I met up with Joel and Ethan, I explored why their Jewish culture hadn't been more overt in their work to date.
It certainly was personal in the respect that we were, you know, we personally lived in a community like that. In 1967, we were around the age of the kids in the movie, and the whole milieu of the movie, the context of the movie, is very familiar to us. So, yeah, I mean, in that respect, yeah.
Normally, when filmmakers start out, they go with what they know. They do the personal ones kind of early, and then they move on to the kind of big things. Right. How comes it's taken you so long to kind of fess up, yeah, come out?
With us, I think it was, you know, we had a fairly, you know, banal and uneventful childhood. It was, I think it took us, you know, 10 or 20, 30, no, 30 years to sort of
even the interest.
Yeah, exactly. It really didn't seem that interesting when it was sort of a fresher experience or more recent experience. I think the age and those many decades of hindsight have made it somewhat more exotic and interesting to us as subject to explore.
Is there, there's a sense also that there's a weighty philosophical edge to this film, which it runs through most of your work as well. But does it take a kind of older head to perhaps understand the questions? Because when the kids are bar mitzvahed, you know, they get a lot of this, you know, stuff. They're reading Torah, they're studying things that many scholars spend years and years studying, and their kids, they're just learning it by rote, really, half the time. They don't know what's going on. Was there a sense that coming to it older and wiser, having gone through some maybe some crises of one's own of faith or what have you, that it helped to come back to it, that it gave you something more to add than just a kind of mere reminiscence and recreation of 67?
Not that we're aware of, and actually, you know, to the extent that there's a text that unlocks the secrets of the universe, as there is at the end of the movie, it's a text that was actually accessible to us as, you know, 12, 13-year-olds at the time, not to give anything away, but it was right there at hand and has been there and has been there all along, as the last rabbi in the movie discloses.
I loved the fact that this rabbi, rather like in the room that we're here, that you have to approach this rabbi through a series of doors. Yeah. There was in my prayer book in High Holy Days at synagogue, there was, when you're not paying attention to what's going on, there's the writings at the back. There's a Paul Simon poem. I always thought that was cool. There's a Kafka story called Vor dem Gesetz, before the law, about a guy sitting. I mean, there was a big angry gatekeeper to the law, and then he shuts the door. That's the final kind of Kafka line. It's a real Kafka erzählung, right? Kind of like a Yiddish folktale. And your story reminded me totally of that. It may be my reading of the Kafka tale, but the layers you have to get to the rabbi, and then when you get there, there's not really a whole lot there.
I understand that, actually. Somebody else mentioned Kafka in relationship to the movie, and I didn't really understand the analogy, but I do understand it in terms of the way you were explaining the... Yes, there's something sort of Kafka-esque, I guess, about having to penetrate many, many layers in order to...
unrevealing sanctum.
Exactly. That is true. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it that way.
It's a good comparison. I hope you don't mind. I mean, he's yeah, kind of he's
as a he knows not chopped liver.
the writing is terrific. If I may turn to the writer, I wondered if the Yiddish folktale that is the prologue, which is just wonderful. You made that up, didn't you? You're making up Yiddish folktales now.
Right, we're making up Yiddish folk. So you're making up Yiddish folktales now. Yes, guilty. We wanted to start with something that would smack of, that would feel like a folktale, and we just didn't know any appropriate ones. So we made up our own. You know, we actually in a pretty self-conscious way made up our own kind of folktale. We read some, you know, Isaac Bashevis Singer, mm-hmm. who likes those kind of stories, who likes those kind of, that kind of marriage of the homey and the supernatural, and just the feeling of that seemed right. So we came up with what you see at the beginning of the movie.
Is there a sense that this has always been lurking in Coen Brothers' work? I mean, it seems that Kafka S would perfectly describe the travails of the dude as well. It seems that this all kind of helps explain the rest of your work.
That's funny.
It's plausible when you say it. We don't really think about it that way. Explain the rest of it. I don't know that there. What needs explaining, really? If there was a mystery, I don't know what it was. But maybe that's Kafka-esque. I don't know. We just throw up our hands at those kind of difficult questions.
the mysteries of life, are they not? This movie asks difficult questions, isn't it?
Yes, it asks them. Yes.
Yeah.
That's true.
No, I wouldn't ask the movies ever to explain them for me.
Yeah. Now, if you actually want the answers, you have to go see Avatar or whatever.
Yeah.
that'll get me to it in another dimension as well. They'll tell me three times how good it is.
That's why Avatar is going to make hundreds of millions of dollars, and ours is not.
I just to come back to the Jewish question. God, I sound like some SS leader. would you say that your films have always been Jewish? Are you Jewish filmmakers?
Yeah, I mean, we're Jewish filmmakers. I guess you could make that case. I certainly, it's certainly true. I guess that we haven't. It's not like we've tiptoed around that before. It's not like we've avoided the subject in terms of. Situations and characters that from other movies, it's not been a preoccupation by any means or even sort of central to anything else that we've done, but it's been there in one form or another in a number of different movies. So
In Barton Fink, I would suppose is probably your most out Jewish character.
Right, Barton Fink, the central character, was Jewish. And The Big Lebowski, since you mentioned it, there was a converted Jew, converted but very observant, devout Jew, yes, played by John Goodman. But the movie business itself has always been, you know, Jewish. Largely Jewish. Mm-hmm. Actually, Jews who, for the most part, wanted to assimilate. A friend of ours said if the movie business weren't difficult, God wouldn't have given it to the Jews.
He was a good friend. This also indulges the Yiddish aspect of it. the Yiddish aspect of it indulges your penchant, which I spoke to you before about, for brilliant names, ridiculous names. Solomon Schlutz.
Oh, that
Solomon
is a good Schlutz. Name, That's actually. Name. Yes. Yeah, that is a good name.
Yeah, the name of the firm was Siegelstein Schlutz, the senior partner, being one of the two partners being Solomon Schlutz. Yeah. Yes, people always wanted to mispronounce it and call him Schultz, and we had to always correct them.
because, I mean, you do good waspy names as well. You've always reveled in a great name. I mean, Larry Gopnik is a good name.
That is a good name. I agree.
I must say, we were hired to adapt a novel by Michael Chabon called The Yiddish Policeman's Union, and it has just great names, great Yiddish, great Jewish names, actually.
Mm-hmm. And are you doing that? Because, I heard you were about to.
We're, I guess... just now, you know, close to finishing the script. Whether or not we make it into a movie or it gets made into a movie is sort of a long road between here and there. It's a studio project.
Right.
So, you know, we'll give it to the studio. Then we'll sort of start down that path and see what's possible or not possible. It's a little unclear to us at this point, to be honest.
And so are you doing something? Are you doing True Grit?
Yeah, right.
Our next movie is True Grit from the novel by Charles Portis. Mm-hmm.
It's a Western.
It's a Western.
It is a Western. I think the only Western he wrote. He wrote four or five novels. It's a very funny book, a very interesting book, much more interesting, I think, than the John Wayne movie that was made from it in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. We're going to see what happens.
If it's anything like a Serious Man, I mean, well, it would be a big surprise if it's anything like a Serious Man.
If it's anything like a Serious Man, we're in big trouble.
But did you enjoy it? Do you enjoy some processes more than others doing some films? Because this one, obviously, you must have recreated your home in some sense. There must have been some fun involved more so than, let's say, like plucking one out of the air, than recreating, say, the Man Who Wasn't There, for example. Although you can tell me that was actually your favorite movie.
It's just a different kind of fun. But yes, it was fun. I mean, there is something that's kind of stimulating, or it gives you a charge somehow, recreating things that are familiar from your childhood, just like it's something people are familiar with. You get a kind of a charge walking into visiting home again if you've been away for a long time, visiting something that's familiar only from childhood. Mm. You get that same kind of kick, yeah.
But as a collaborative process between brothers, you obviously always collaborate, but was there this one, but you remember when, you know, we'd have this to eat, or that sort of detail, that Jewish National Fund yellow and blue, blue and white box, for example.
Blue and white box is a good example. There was a little bit of that. I mean, I think we were pretty much, most of those sort of elements we had sort of worked out ahead of time. We did, I think, each individually and together have a lot of fun with the set decorator. We, for instance, asked her to put a copy of Chaim Putuk's The Chosen in every, you know, living room, and Abba Eban's, you know,
Our People.
I think we also asked her to scatter a few, you know, Yigael Alon, Masadas around.
Yeah.
The ones you found in every sort of middle class Midwestern or Eastern Jewish household.
Yeah, we had James A. Mission as the source.
Oh, yeah. The source, of course. Oh, yes. How could we have forgotten that? Yeah. But yes, those things were fun.
A Serious Man is not out this week. It's out next Shabbos, Friday, the 20th of November. And believe me, it's well worth the wait. Coincidentally, the 13th Jewish Film Festival is taking place here in London from November the 7th. So to mark the festival, Guardian's Sounds Jewish podcast is presented by yours truly, and it's a Jewish Film Festival special. Oi, check it out at guardian.co.uk/audio. Joining me to run down this week's releases is Guardian critic at large, Zan Brooks. Welcome to the resplendently lit pod. This week we're going to be looking at Michael Haneke's Palme d'Or winner, The White Ribbon. We'll be looking at Ang Lee's latest, Taking Woodstock. And we'll be looking at Roland Emmerich's 2012, or 2012, or 2012. We'll come to that a bit later. Let's start with Michael Haneke and The White Ribbon. As I said, it won the Palme d'Or in Cannes back in May, and now arrives on our screens. Stark black and white exploration of a German rural village in 1913, where strange things are happening and the children are getting it.
Sei aufrichtig, Martin. Warum bist du so rot und unruhig geworden bei der Geschichte des armen Knaben?
Rot? Ich weiß nicht, es tut mir irgendwie leid um ihn.
Ja, ist das alles? Ich denke, dass es noch eine Ursache gibt.
The great German actor Burkhard Klausner there giving it to one of his children. This Is Michael Haneke at his most kind of ascetic, I think, Zan?
Yeah, this is a very formal and precise piece of work. It's like a kind of beautiful ice sculpture, this film. And there's a lot of talk about it being a whodunit, which is perhaps misleading and also maybe a bit damaging to the film as a whole. If you kind of shine too much light on it, it all starts to melt away because it's a very elusive and an enigmatic piece of work.
I think people who've seen and enjoyed Michael Haneke's previous work, Hidden, will find a lot of parallels in this one. For me, this is sort of hidden before the days of surveillance cameras. This is hidden in 19th century, into sort of early 20th century Germany. This is a whodunit without a kind of mystery to solve, really.
Yeah, it's set in a very feudal society in rural Germany in the run-up to the First World War, and there's these series of crimes. And it's a film that kind of builds to the outbreak of the First World War, but it seems to implicitly foreshadow the war that follows. And there's the slight sense that these strange midwitch cuckoo-style children are maybe the future ambassadors of National Socialism. And there's a sense here that, in his very subtle way, Haneke is saying that Germany is kind of incubating monsters.
Is he blaming, do you think, the parents that we see there, the pastor giving very strict instructions to his son? But there's also a doctor who's got a Down syndrome, isn't the best father in the world. There's a baron who's a bit of a sort of lax father as well. Is there a sort of sense that I think there was in Hidden that the sins of the fathers are then visited on the next generation?
I think there is that sense, but I think there's also the sense that it's even more endemic than that, that it's basically a corrupt, dysfunctional society. It's a very closed, ordered society. There's the haves and there's the have-nots, and everyone is in their place. And there is this burning resentment because of that, that comes out in these sort of poisonous, thwarted ways.
I love that about Michael Haneke. I think in Hidden, you have that scene where Daniel O'Toole and Juliette Binoche are sort of in the street, and then a cyclist just comes past them. And it's like, you end up fearing, when you get to know your Haneke, you end up fearing every single shot. You think, oh my God, something awful's going to happen. And almost from the start, that happens in this film. I mean, it's almost like ghostly in a way, this film. Sort of got elements of gothic horror, those midwitch-type children, you say, and that we see them in the gloaming, in their white robes as well.
Yeah, he does conjure up this world of great foreboding. It has to be said, this is a beautiful-looking film. It's shot in amazing monochromatic cinema. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of Bergman at times, a little bit of Terrence Malick. And I think it probably is a masterpiece.
It was funny because it played quite near the end of Cannes, if you remember, and sort of no one quite knew what was going to win. Maybe it was the Jacques Audiard film Prophet. That was sort of the best film up to then. And then sort of this comes along, White Ribbon, and played on the final Thursday. And you just went, yeah, all right, Michael, you're really good. And you're just the best. You know what I mean? We're all going to bow before you. You are the master, der Meister.
It is a perfect film, I guess, with all that entails. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's perfectly enjoyable and perfectly satisfying. It is a finely honed monolith of a film that you admire to the sky and back, but it doesn't leave you much room to find a place in it.
And that's even in the language. It is in German, of course, and there's no more precise language. And it's in a beautiful German. It's in that real turn of the century German. There's some beautiful writing, Gothic script that is just very, very there. It's just a faszinierendes Gebäude, as they say in Germany.
Well, and as you say here, I have no idea what that means, but, you know, I'll give it a thumbs up. How about that?
Vorsprung der Technik as well, to Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon, an unimpeachable masterpiece, but maybe too scary for words. Zan, let's move on to another fine director, a previous Oscar winner, director Ang Lee, a Taiwan-born director, now working and living in the US. Previously, he's done, of course, Brokeback Mountain and Last Caution, and now turns his attention to the 60s, to Woodstock. Here, in the clip we're about to see, Dimitri Martin, in his film debut, plays Elliot Tiber. He's hiring a security guard for the farm where Woodstock is about to take place. It's Liev Schreiber in a wig.
That's me with the cigar. The other one was the love of my life. Killed. Sniper. I went out on patrol, found the Chinese pissant who did it, and broke his neck with my own hands.
Jesus.
Actually, I made that last part up, but I would have if I'd gotten hold of the son of a bitch, and I'd do it today if I found him.
Filmer. You're hired.
Thank you.
Welcome aboard.
You won't regret it.
Do you need some kind of uniform?
Oh, I've got uniforms, babe.
Well, amid the mud and the hippies, there's a film breaking out here. It's called Taking Woodstock. Ang Lee, a very different territory to the last couple of films.
It's a real change of pace for him, this. And again, this played at Cannes, and I think caught people by surprise a little bit. I mean, this comes after, obviously, Brokeback Mountain, but it also comes after Lust Caution, which was incredibly dark and tangled and steamy. This is light and airy, perfectly amiable, and maybe a little bit insipid, in that it deals out all the things that we know or think we know about Woodstock and the late 60s era. It's about a Jewish kid, Elliot Tiber, played by Dimitri Martin, who works at the motel, squabbles with his parents, and then invites the festival organisers to the field to lay on Woodstock. And that's the cue for the great sexual and gender revolution of Woodstock. But it's also the cue for a lot of, I don't know, low comedy. A lot of, you know, there's the obligatory Vietnam vet who goes kind of nuts in the woods.
Yes, that young man who was in the Sean Penn film.
Emile Hirsch, yeah. There's the parents, but you know, Imelda Staunton in a very kind of broad role.
Yeah,
as
it didn't work for you. I mean, it's kind of the main thing of the movie for me. I like Dimitri Martin, but there was Imelda Staunton, previously Vera Drake. Here she is playing kind of Yiddish mama who schlepped all the way from Minsk. And then there's Henry Goodman, who's kind of giving it broad, kind of, yeah, a rich man kind of thing going on. He's just been playing Fiddler on the Roof. I wasn't sure about the casting of them or the reason for them, if it worked. Why
and the comedy
British?
That comes out of it. It was dodgy comedy a little bit. And also there's the whole thing about, there's the moment where the hash brownies come into the motel and you just know the mum is going to eat the hash brownies and she's going to let her hair down and it's all going to be wonderful.
That said, it sort of worked for me. Yeah. I found it amiable, as you say. It made me laugh. He's obviously been in this territory before, Ang Lee, as you'll see in a director's chair interview that I've done with the man, and we'll be playing that next week. But he's done this before in, of course, at Upstate New York with Sigourney Weaver and Kevin Kline in The Ice Storm, and I thought that was a brilliant kind of look at Upstate New York suburbia. This is slightly sort of patchier. But nevertheless, I sort of was kind of enveloped in the warmth of it. I like the story of Woodstock told sort of in the wings. This was a kind of little man story about a great event, which I have seen a documentary for, and is obviously kind of a seismic event in American culture. And this was sort of how it affected people, which is something we've not really seen before.
I totally agree with you. That is the selling point of it.
Because I did think it was beautifully shot by Eric Gauthier, one of my favourite cinematographers. And there's that kind of, I think it's completely nicked from Godard's Weekend, where they kind of look at the traffic line, and it's just complete a dolly shot from there. But it is beautifully done.
It's beautifully done, and at the same time, it's faintly pointless.
Yeah, and there's an acid trip in there. I mean, I haven't seen an acid trip. People don't do that anymore. The last one was in that terrible film, Bobby, that Emilio Estevez directed. There was an acid trip to Jefferson Airplane's White Rabbit. Ooh, that's trendy.
It's that thing that maybe an acid trip is great when you're having it, but to actually watch people having an acid trip is one of the most tedious things in the world.
So there's Taking Woodstock. To take stock of Taking Woodstock, it's kind of tedious and amiable. Would you recommend people go and see it?
It's one of those things that if you catch it on TV or even on DVD, you'd think that's a perfectly pleasant 2 hours. But to actually, to make the trip, as it were, isn't really worth it.
Taking Woodstock at Ang Lee. Let's move on to a rather different pace of film altogether. It's Roland Emmerich, the man who gave us Independence Day and The Day After Tomorrow. He's a disaster waiting to happen, Roland Emmerich. It's 2012, but he's turned the disaster movie up to 11. Here's John Cusack, who plays a novelist who's kind of predicted this sort of disaster, as the Mayans have as well. He's rounding up his family to get the hell out of Los Angeles.
Hello?
Kate, stop what you're doing.
Jackson?
Listen to me. I've rented a plane. Pack up the kids. I'm going to be there in 5 minutes.
What are you talking about?
Kate, California is going down.
God, you sound like a crazy person. The governor just said we're fine now.
The guy's an actor. He's reading a script. When they tell you not to panic, that's when you run.
John Cusack in Con Air. No. That's not Con Air. This is 2012 or 2012 or whatever. Roland Emmerich's doing it again. He's blowing up the world.
Is there nothing that he won't do to blow up the world? This is a very alarming film, in fact, because it turns out that we're all doomed, according to the Mayan prophecy, on the December the 21st, 2012.
Yeah.
It's all going to
just
hell in a handbasket. Just after the Olympics. So here we have the Earth's crust dissolving, the core cooking up like a microwave. And what else? I mean, you know, the White House gets flattened by an aircraft carrier that gets rolled in by a tsunami, which is like this great double whammy. And Christ the Redeemer topples off his perch above Rio de Janeiro,
which is getting the next Olympics, so it's kind of an Olympic thing going. The Vatican.
Don't worry about the Olympics.
The Vatican crumbles on some cardinals. They're praying with all their might. It doesn't save them. The Sistine Chapel cracks on top of them. I gather he was also going to film Mecca falling apart, but feared sort of the vengeful wrath of Muslim.
Why would he fear that if we're all doomed? Just do it.
He'd be fine.
Well, you know. He can survive a fatwa for 3 years, and then he's going to get got by the tidal wave.
Doesn't the destruction around it, I mean, it looks pretty cool on screen, I have to say, and the world was ending, but I was going, wow, that looks good.
It does look great, and it has a fantastic chase scene through a sort of collapsing Los Angeles, where the buildings are all telescoping down, and John Cusack's in his car, desperately trying to get his family out of town, which is really kind of wonderful in that sort of idiotic, nonsensical way.
There's something, I mean, clever as we might be talking about Michael Haneke and watching things in Cannes, there's something about cinema, isn't there, when there's a bloke driving a car and you think things are going to collapse and you'll just go like this with him. Would I go see it in the cinema? I think I would, because this is where you're supposed to see it. It's going to look rubbish on DVD, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is a total B-movie. It's a B-movie with an A-movie budget. And the special effects are incredible. The human effects are, they're just basically kind of cannon fodder, really. Although you have got Danny Glover as the noble American president.
A black president, Zan.
A black president.
It'll never happen.
Who decides to go down with the ship and stay with his people. Interestingly, though, the only other world leader who does that is the Italian prime minister, who also elects not to get on board the Ark to freedom and stays at home. And that surely can't be Berlusconi.
It can't be. They don't mention him by name, but he's probably comfortable.
I mean,
at
Berlusconi
home.
He'd claw women and children out of the way to get there. And then he'd stipulate that no gypsies would be allowed on the Ark.
2012, are you going to go to the cinema to see it if you hadn't already gone and been paid to do so?
I would genuinely recommend this. I went in thinking this is going to be big and dumb and stupid, and it totally is.
Brilliant.
And yet it's great.
Absolutely. It's stupid, it's big, and it's not clever, but it's brilliant to watch. 2012 by Roland Emmerich. Zan, lovely to see you as ever. Thank you for coming in the pod.
Thank you.
You're beautifully lit. You're like Marlene Dietrich.
I am exactly like that.
And I am Emil Jannings at your mercy, the Blue Angel, invoked at the end of Film Weekly's review section. My thanks to Zan Brooks for his reviews as ever there. You can read all of his cultural musings at guardian.co.uk/film. And if you're curious about Roland Emmerich, well, I've got just what you're looking for.
Look, what do people care really today about some local disaster? They see this on TV. Mm. Don't forget, in the 70s, you know, stuff like this you didn't see on TV. Now, you know, see everything on TV.
Yeah.
And because of that, you know, you have to kind of move to bigger ideas. Mm.
Yes, I put a major Hollywood whirlwind in the director's chair. My series continues with Roland Emmerich. To watch it, all you've got to do is go to guardian.co.uk/in the director's chair.
I don't reckon you've got long. Seen that before. Gut wound. The slugs. Probably torn right through your liver. Mate of mine in Ulster got caught in sniper fire. Bullet blew his inside out. He screamed for a good 10 minutes. We couldn't send a medic in. The section was too hot. So we all took cover and watched him die.
Michael Caine there, in his brooding and vengeful new role as the eponymous Harry Brown, which tells of Harry's impotence as his old friend Leonard is bullied and murdered by local youths and Michael's violent search for truth and justice. Directed by newcomer Daniel Barber, this gritty, almost dirty revenge thriller has already prompted a few columnists into a lather of polemic over the social breakdown of London life. So, when I met up with Daniel, I started out by suggesting to him that his film tapped into a tabloidy notion of the capital's estates.
I don't think in any way that this film is about or is part of, you know, a hype or a myth that's being set up by the newspapers. It's very much the truth. I spent a lot of time with the police researching the film. You know, normal people are being affected every day by gangs of youths. There are no-go areas on estates, but more than on estates now, on whole streets in certain areas, there is this sort of postcode war going on between gangs and so on. You know, it's less. It's not. We don't have a race problem so much anymore. We have this. We have a youth problem. You know, gangs of youths, kids who feel disenfranchised from our society. Yeah. They're not a part of what goes on. They don't have any great education or any. They don't have a feeling that they want to get any education. They don't see the use of it. They don't want a regular job. They want what they want when they want it. They see MTV. They see guys with beautiful girls and Lamborghinis and loads of bling, and that's what they want.
Yeah. Interesting. Your film doesn't really sort of seek to understand them, though. Your film sort of seeks to punish them, or is it? It's Harry Brown's character who doesn't want to understand them anymore.
Well, I think Harry Brown, as an older member of society, is really. Doesn't understand them at all, doesn't understand why people would want to behave as they do. You know, he, like most of us, comes from a background where, I'm very lucky, and I'm sure you were. I had nice parents, loving parents who encouraged me, wanted me to have good education. As did Michael. He had very poor, humble origins, and he was a member of a gang, but he would never have done the kind of things they do. You know, but then we didn't have, you know, the sort of drug problem we have today, and the sort of monies that you can get by selling drugs, as a lot of these kids do.
There's a very poignant moment in your film where you compare the Troubles to Northern Ireland, where Michael Caine's character has been sort of a Marine, and he says, no, but they had a cause. Mm. Rather, that's his world-weary moment. I mean, that he almost is sort of on the point of giving up there when he realises that what is all this violence
Absolutely.
For?
Well, I mean, as he says in that, you know, he says to them out there, this is just entertainment, and that is what it is.
But, yeah, I mean, you having spent time with it, and now you've made a film about it. And as I said, I do worry... That the film, you say, it, making a film that is entertainment about this, not that your film is, I wouldn't call it, fun night out, because it is a very unsettling piece.
But I'm not exploiting the situation by making a dramatic entertainment. It is an entertainment, but is it not better to create something that draws people in, that hopefully will make them think about what is going on, rather than a documentary? I think the problem with a lot of documentaries, as far as younger people are concerned, is they're dull. And they're boring, and they're aimed at middle-class intelligentsia. Those are the people that watch documentaries and get terribly upset by them. But I don't think the kids give a stuff, and that's a very polite way of saying it.
Did you, when you were doing research and casting for these kids, and some of them among real kids, did you have to sort of change your ideas and change your script as you went along, as you discovered certain things about the system?
Yeah, very much so. I think the script at an early stage it wasn't a rough outline, but it proved in many parts to be that, because the kids brought, as did all the actors, but the kids especially brought so much to it. You know, not only in that, well, I wouldn't say it like that, this is what I'd say, fine, that's no problem. You know, the script was always written as, this is the intention of what you're about or what you're going to say. You don't have to say it like that at all. You should say it as you feel comfortable and as is accurate and as is right for you. And the language of the film is wholly realistic, obviously.
One of the best things about the film is the language. I thought it was very great. I mean, I don't know the street language off by heart like that, but this one felt real to me.
It is very, very real, and the kids, for the most part, we used are the real deal. Jamie Downey, who plays Carl in the piece, has had a very tough and difficult upbringing, as have many of the other kids.
Your film, I think, you know, some reviews have said it, you know, it's a blend of Ken Loach meets Michael Winner in a way. It starts out as a social realist piece.
God forbid it's like Michael Winner. I don't think there's anything Michael Winner about it at all. I mean,
I think it's the vigilante aspect.
Well, okay. Well, you know, it's far from a genre movie. It treats the audience with much more intelligence than that. And that would be the more Ken Loach side of it. But, you know, the film has a very particular visual look about it.
I was extremely impressed, particularly the descent into hell, which I think was like a sort of inferno bit where he goes to see Sean Harris's dealer, it's an extraordinary performance. I know Judi Dench got her Oscar for like 3 minutes of being Queen Elizabeth in Shakespeare in Love. Sean Harris's supporting performance in that scene is outstanding.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that, and Sean did an amazing job. And, you know, that was a very interesting scene to do. Because it was relentless when we filmed it, and it was relentless when it was being written. And Sean was a part of writing that scene.
I couldn't believe Michael Caine, he's a very rich man, he's got a beautiful wife, he's had a lovely career, he used to do Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, he used to open up scripts and go, exterior day, south of France, I'm in. Suddenly now he's like, it's interior, Stygian gloom, drug dealers, flack, shit everywhere.
I know. Yeah, because it was very funny. I mean, look, when we were developing the scene, it was a revolting place, which Michael didn't much like. That's for sure. None of us did, because it was rat-infested and the roof leaked and it was horrendous. But I remember when we were developing the script, you know, Sean would ad-lib some of the things. I would go through it with him on the side. So, should I say this? Should I say that? I said, yeah, try that. And he did this brilliant thing where he went up to Michael for the first time. Michael didn't know it. And he says, can't you get your cock hard anymore, old man? And I just thought, that's outrageous. Nobody can say that to Michael Caine. But it was weird. And then it had this funny thing where we did one of the first screenings. Michael and Shakira came along. Of course, I ended up sitting next to Shakira, and all I could think about was, oh, my goodness, he's going to say to Michael in a minute, you can't get your cock hard anymore. And I'm just sitting next to his wife. She's going to elbow me or something.
I thought she might turn to you and say, I can actually vouch for Michael's cock to be in perfectly fine working conditions.
Well, I wouldn't know.
Dan, thank you very much. Lovely to see you on Film Weekly. It is. And any stories about Michael Caine's private parts are welcome on Film Weekly. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
My thanks to Daniel Barber there, and if you want to see if Michael Caine can still keep it up, in acting terms of course, well, Harry Brown is on general release from this Friday, the 13th of November. And that's all for this week. Pick up a copy of The Observer on Sunday for my trailer trash column. The music featured in the show this week is from Taking Woodstock and the brooding Taxi Driver-esque score to Harry Brown by up-and-coming British composers Ruth Barrett and Martin Phipps. No relation to our Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps. Thanks for listening. I've been Jason Solomons. Till next week, goodbye.